Well, my topic in my paper today will be divine. All of my lectures are divine. All of my sermons are divine. My wife's maiden name is Moore, and so she's more divine than I am. But I made her that way. When I found her, she was just Moore. It was really something of an embarrassment that I rescued her from. And my more divine wife used to date George Clooney, the George Clooney. So I beat Batman. I gave her what George Clooney could not, poverty. I really didn't mean to become interested in the emerging church phenomenon. I really backed into it, kind of stepped in it without meaning to. At that time, my concern, before I even knew the emerging church existed, was the specter of death looming over an historic Baptist church I found myself pastor of in Midtown, Kansas City, Missouri. It was founded in 1840, 5 years before a group of ministers would gather in Augusta, Georgia to launch the denomination these Missouri Baptists would soon join. I found at First Calvary Baptist Church an urban congregation halfway into its third decade of decline. We gathered to worship in a magnificent sanctuary adorned by stained glass bearing the names of Warnell and Ward, names also attached to two of Kansas City's famed boulevards. A balcony there stretches into an impressive gallery on both sides of the pulpit. An arched ceiling terminates in an ornate alcove framed by carved wood and beveled glass, acting as prisms that throw off narrow, brilliant splotches of rainbow light here and there. It was like a mini Spurgeon's tabernacle. These were Smells and Bells Baptists, not my kind of Baptists. In its heyday, two services were required to accommodate the more than 1,000 Baptists who made their way to First Calvary on a typical Lord's Day. I was mesmerized by this worship space, not just because of its beauty, but because its beauty was set within a strategic location for Southern Baptists. I am incurably Southern Baptist, I think. A malady that, unfortunately, fewer and fewer folks suffer from. Fewer and fewer suffer from being incurably Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, or anything else. Across the denominational spectrum, folks are just not sitting all the way down in their pews the way they once did. The fastest growing segment of Christian identity in North America is non-denominational. But that's not true for me. I can remember flipping through my baptism Bible, confused that Lottie Moon's name did not occur in the concordance anywhere at all. What kind of Bible was it that they'd given me? Even if I changed denominations, if I left Southern Baptist for another denomination, I think I would still be Southern Baptist. Maybe it's like being a Jew. I wonder that I cannot stop being Southern Baptist. When I learned that John A. Broadus had preached one of the dedicatory sermons for one of the previous worship houses for First Calvary, my denominational juices flowed even quicker, and my protective instincts for that church increased. The spectacle of this once vibrant congregation dying before our very eyes cut me to the quick, spiritually speaking. The impending demise of First Calvary threatened the loss of the gospel witness in the historic Westport section of Kansas City, just as it was witnessing a renaissance, an influence of new residents. Westport was then an urban landscape in transition, energized by a vibrant entertainment district and a magnet for singles and young couples attracted to the ethnically and socially diverse environment this neighborhood might provide. A stroll down Westport Road now promised encounters not only with a pierced and tattooed populace, but also with bankers, business people, musicians, and artists of most every stripe, and even the occasional new mother with stroller proudly pushing her newborn child along. New residential construction alongside established neighborhoods held out the possibility of a new and fascinating field for gospel advance amidst perhaps the most resistant of settings for such advance in the 21st century, not only in North America but around the globe, our great cities. Over the course of 7 years, I poured myself into the pursuit of a new future for First Calvary Baptist Church. In 2008, less than 70 members were losing the battle to maintain the magnificently but rapidly deteriorating facilities. We voted to merge with an emerging Southern Baptist Church in St. Louis, the other side of the state, a church that embraces the Baptist faith and message 2000 without apology. This St. Louis church deployed a replanter to First Calvary. 1 month ago, this all started in around May of 2008. 1 month ago, 675 persons gathered in two services to worship on the Lord's Day at the replanted and newly renamed Redeemer Fellowship, where the whiff of impending death once hovered over a declining flock and a deteriorating and gravely threatened facility. Now the most pressing problems stem from rapid growth. My experience at First Calvary prompted me to explore the emerging church movement more closely. In the wake of the extraordinary developments at First Calvary, I found myself increasingly convinced that there were convictions, insights, energies, and goals churning within the emerging church movement that were much needed by evangelicals at this crucial historical crossroads for Christianity in North America. Convictions, insights, energies, and goals I desperately want my beloved denomination to benefit from. I also became, and I remain, convinced that Southern Baptists have much to offer emerging church leaders who are doctrinally orthodox and evangelical, but who falsely imagine that a non-denominational trajectory better serves their aspirations for the communities of faith they have planted. I want to survey a few of these benefits I believe the emerging church can bring to Southern Baptists, but first, a brief word about the emerging church itself and which stream within the movement I shall be referring to in this lecture most frequently. I've also found it helpful to divide the movement into two major streams, one doctrine-friendly stream and another stream, which I call emergent, that is composed of two substreams, one doctrine averse and one doctrine wary. The doctrine averse emerging church folks have no doctrine at all. The doctrine wary, usually some minimum amount of doctrine. But it's the doctrine-friendly stream that especially interests me as I consider the future of the Southern Baptist denomination. The doctrine-averse emerging churches subscribe to no formal doctrinal stance whatsoever. Significant influencers among this group are becoming less and less interested in and protective of even the adjective Christian to describe who they are and where they are headed. The doctrine-wary communities of faith are those emerging churches who may have launched themselves without doctrine, but have taken on usually the Apostles or the Nicene Creed or both. While the transition from a doctrine-averse posture to mere wariness for doctrine marks a welcome development, a potentially deadly blind spot remains: the failure to fully recognize the irreducibly doctrinal character of Christianity. Be that as it may, my main interest is in the movement that centers around the doctrine-friendly stream of emerging. These communities of faith embrace fully orbed confessions of faith that situate them squarely within Orthodox and Evangelical Christianity from a doctrinal standpoint. They affirm historic Christian thinking on the doctrine of the Trinity and the person of Jesus Christ as articulated in the Apostles and Nicene Constantinopolitan creeds of the early church. And they affirm both the formal and material theological bases of the Protestant Reformation, namely insistence upon salvation by grace alone, through Jesus Christ alone, by faith alone, on the basis of the testimony of Scripture alone. And unlike most of the doctrine-averse and doctrine-wary contingent of emerging, They do not shy away from objective understandings of the atonement accomplished by Jesus Christ through the incarnation and his death on the cross. While the left wing of the emerging church, in similar ways and for similar reasons as Protestant liberals did, they tend to reduce the work of Jesus Christ to variations of moral influence and exemplarist construals of Christ's life and death. The doctrine-friendly folks tend to embrace robust affirmation of substitutionary atonement. Also, while the left wing of emerging, again reminiscent of Protestant liberals, have developed a bad conscience for proselytizing, and thus they often speak of belonging before believing, the doctrine-friendly stream believes in conversion-seeking evangelism. So what do these theologically orthodox and evangelical emerging communities bring to the table? How might Southern Baptists benefit from their efforts, their vision, and even from them? Well, first, they are church-planting fixated. The entire emerging phenomenon, I use the word emerging to speak about the whole movement, the whole phenomenon. The entire emerging phenomenon is characterized by an impressive zeal for church planting. Dissatisfied for a variety of reasons with models of church that nurtured them or those that they have otherwise encountered, emerging church leaders plant churches. Perhaps the most misinformed comments I encounter about the emerging church are those that apply a quick and dirty analysis that ends by reducing and dismissing the phenomenon as the convulsions of typical youth rebellion against grandma and grandpa's religion. Well, emerging church leaders do tend to be quite young. The first wave involved mostly men in their 20s and early 30s. And young people do act like young people. That much is true. But the first wave of church planters, this first wave of church planters has aged by 10 to 15 years since then. And let's ask ourselves this question. When young men dissatisfied with the models of church that nurtured them strike out on their own and actually plant churches, how typical is that? Church planting is not child's play. Neither is church replanting of the type that took place at First Calvary in Kansas City. It's not play at all. It's a fairly impressive way to rebel, I think. And many of these church planters are Southern Baptists. Some of them would like to stay Southern Baptists. Others, I believe, could be attracted to the SBC. Well, they're not only church planting fixated, but many of them are cityfied church planters. Not only are they attracted to church planting, but they're especially attracted, many of them, disproportionately so, to urban settings. For many, the more cityfied the context, the more they salivate at the prospects of seeing the gospel advance. I now live in Alabama, not a state boasting a great megalopolis for sure. But if you want to find emerging churches there, go to downtown Birmingham or to downtown Huntsville, and there you will find these young men laboring away in these challenging ministry settings. As North America and indeed the world becomes more and more urban, missiologists can tell us and chart for us and give us numbers showing how forbidding urban terrain proves for would-be church planters from Birmingham to Boston to Bangkok, where I once served on a church planting team. Yet right here under our noses are not a few ecclesiologically Baptistic and theologically evangelical church planters pouring their lives out to reach the lost with a zeal and a willingness to sacrifice comparable to the great missionaries we Baptists have long revered. And some of these communities of faith have been very effective, spectacularly so. Ought not such a spectacle of missionary effort, expended in some of the most difficult settings imaginable, animate the Baptist mind and tug at the Baptist heartstrings? It does mine. At a time when so many Baptist churches are seemingly stuck in a downward spiral, at a loss as to the path forward, and in something of an embattled mode and in retreat from the strange, changing, and increasingly post-Christian culture around them, What a bright and shining light to see young church planters who believe in the inerrancy and full authority of the Bible, so immersed in a marvelous work in the cities of America. There is a vibrant and robust missionary zeal at work within some of our young people. Let's be alert to this, where strong and deep theological affinity prevails. Let us be slow to view those who have embraced these common theological convictions with a jaundiced eye. Let's be slow. Let's let shared theology do its proper work and give us patience with these young men. Well, these doctrine-friendly emerging churches also speak of being missional. They want to plant what they call missional churches. I want to highlight two ways in which this term is employed by emerging church leaders. First, missional churches are contrasted with attractional ones. An attractional church focuses disproportionate energy into what takes place within the walls of its church buildings. The worship services, religious education, various clubs, recreation, and other programs. All of these are advertised and promoted in various ways and are meant to attract both unchurched believers and unbelievers into the church's facilities, where enjoyment of the various programmatic offerings keep them there. Once someone crosses the threshold of that church facility, much of the work of church growth is done. And this has been spectacularly effective in many ways. Emerging churches may recognize the appropriateness of attractional models for some, but they're also convinced that growing proportions of the unbelieving population will not be reached by such an approach. Some unbelievers must be reached outside the walls of the church building. They must be reached where people live, work, study, and play. This brings us to a second meaning the word missional carries for the emerging church. Every believer is equally and always on mission. Every believer bears the burden and enjoys the responsibility of missionary service, and every follower of Jesus Christ should be equipped for such missionary service right here at home. Tuscaloosa must be approached with full seriousness as a mission field, as surely and profoundly as one might approach Turkey or Tajikistan or Timbuktu. These churches also mean to be culture conscious. And that brings us to what might prove to be the most welcome and most enduring contribution of the emerging church to North American Christianity. It is their conviction that increasingly North America is made up of multiple subcultures. No longer can Christian believers and would-be evangelists expect to encounter unbelievers with whom they share a deep and wide and rich cultural heritage across great swaths of geography, not even in the South. Even there, you can drive across town or even walk across the street, which few do, and find yourself plunged into a subculture where familiar speech and custom, and most importantly, shared meanings are difficult to come by. The cultural diversification occurring in North America matters for those who would see the gospel advance and Bible-believing evangelical churches planted for the same reason culture has always and obviously mattered when a missionary is, let us say, dropped from rural or suburban or Kansas City into urban Thailand as I was. Because culture profoundly affects the conveyance of meaning. And the gospel is a message with a meaning that must be conveyed in order to be believed. The cultural distances we are traversing as we make our way in and around the lower 48 states does not always feel so significant, and certainly not so jarring, as one experiences between, say, Jackson and Jakarta. But the emerging church is here to tell us that these lesser cultural distances are real, and that nonchalance with respect to them will inhibit effective communication of the gospel. Yes, millions of Americans can still understand the gospel communicated in ways largely unchanged from the language and techniques that prevailed and proved effective in the 1950s in, let's say, Knoxville, Tennessee. But the emerging church warns fewer and fewer of those we wish to reach can do so. Therefore, says the emerging church, culture should be studied with great care and with missiological questions in mind, in much the same way as it has been studied by the great mission-sending agencies for decades. Perhaps best symbolized and illustrated by the recognition that efforts to put tops on bare-breasted natives in Asia and Africa inhibited the advance of the gospel by erecting unnecessary stumbling blocks to faith. We study culture not to discover the gospel, but to discover the best ways of communicating the unchanging gospel within a particular cultural context. Set me down in a place that's my cultural milieu, and I say things and do things that are, and refrain from saying and doing things that are just right for that context. I don't even realize it's going on. But pick us up and put us down in a cultural context we don't understand, and we're alienating those we would win to the gospel without realizing it as well. Ironically, what these missional emerging church planters are striving to approximate, whether they realize it or not, is perhaps the most spectacular church planting movement North America has ever seen, namely the rise of the Southern Baptist Convention of Churches between 1845 and whenever we stopped growing. Part of what accounts for the exponential growth of Southern Baptists is that pretty much optimal cultural conditions prevailed across an enormous geographical expanse, allowing an ease of communication, a natural, or to use a favorite emerging word, organic conveyance of meaning. The difference is that we just grew up on that soil. We didn't think missionally to do it because we didn't have to. But now with the changing cultural landscape, we have to treat our own land as a mission field. Now I want to say a word about evangelism. Many left-wing emerging church leaders, the emergent stream, suffer from a bad conscience when it comes to proselytizing. But the doctrine-friendly stream of emerging, the right wing, if you will, believes strongly in conversion-seeking evangelism. However, some do practice a kind of patience in evangelism that may make some Southern Baptists a little nervous. It may suggest an unseemly lack of urgency where heaven and hell hang in the balance. They may welcome a delay in direct conversion-seeking evangelism. Why do they do this? Once again, culture matters here. Conveyance of meaning matters. Many wise Southern Baptists these days are expressing the need to recover zeal for the historic Baptist insistence upon a regenerate church membership. Are not many of us quite convinced that we have, due to a variety of causes as a denomination, unwittingly and unintentionally perhaps, we have helped many unconverted persons to think themselves born again? Neither the baptized unconverted nor the local congregations they inhabit for however long are helped where such scenarios play out. In fact, both are harmed. Harmed by our praiseworthy but imprudent evangelistic zeal. Someone has said if all the conversions reported in Thailand are true across the years, that today there are more believers in Thailand than there are people. They smile, they agree, they'll even be baptized, but when it's all said and done, less than 0.5% of Thailand is Christian, and included in that number are Roman Catholics and Mormons. But it's recorded back home as a conversion, and money is raised on the basis of those numbers. Harmed. Emerging churches are convinced that where evangelism must be done in a context increasingly post-Christian and subculture-shaped, as prevails in North America, taking time to gain more confidence that the gospel has been truly communicated and truly believed before filling up the baptismal pool is warranted. Perhaps the place where evangelicals have been most willing to accept deliberate delay in direct conversion-seeking evangelism is in the adoption on the international field of the methods of New Tribes Mission, who spend months teaching foundational biblical truths to tribal peoples in order to establish a necessary knowledge base without which New Tribes believe such groups, due to profound cultural and worldview differences, cannot comprehend the gospel. So they delay direct conversion-seeking evangelism for the sake of seeing genuine conversion. And they have seen spectacular results by doing so, but they had to wait in order to see those results. Well, delay of direct conversion-seeking evangelism, and especially delay of baptism and formal incorporation within the body of believers among these churches, is meant to honor the seriousness of the commitment expected within these doctrine-loving, and discipline-practicing congregations. Such caution and conscientiousness would seem to share much with early Baptists, who, while they pressed the claims of Christ, to use one of Timothy George's favorite words in this context, while they pressed the claims of Christ promiscuously, anybody can hear the gospel anytime, they guarded the baptismal pool with a bit more vigilance than Baptists of the last several decades have been inclined to do. To quote Tertullian, that brilliant and sarcastic, sometime orthodox, sometime heretical North African teacher of the 3rd century, "If we better understood the true character of baptism, we might fear its reception more than its delay." And now I want to speak about community. Spend some time exploring one of the most consistently and fervently expressed pursuits of emerging church planters: the quest for community in the context of church. This yearning for community is variously expressed as the search for authentic relationships, authentic community, embodied Christianity. They want communities characterized by transparency, mutual openness, forgiveness, and love. Places where brokenness is welcome, where shattered lives find genuine healing within authentic Christian siblinghood. They want churches in which, in the deepest sense of the word, members belong to one another and together to their Savior and Lord. In some ways, they want a church that is worthy of the theme song of Cheers, "Wouldn't You Like to Get Away?" Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name. You want to go where they see all your troubles are the same. Here, one of the most prominent interests of the emerging churches surely dovetails with one of the most eroded dimensions of church life, and indeed of human life in our time. The significance of the human longing evoked by the mention of the word community is evidenced perhaps most concretely by the massive effort investors are making these days in the construction of so-called mixed-use developments. Attempts to approximate some of the conditions that once characterized small-town America, and still does in some places, or even safe urban neighborhoods, places that accommodate and facilitate frequency of contact and intimate human interaction, abound today, these efforts. Emerging church leaders want to see a deeper and higher quality of relationship flourishing within their local church settings, and are convinced that while such a vision accords with the body life described in 1 Corinthians 12 and elsewhere in the Bible, it is eluding more and more followers of Jesus in our time. Was not more of this quality and depth of community enjoyed by a much higher percentage of Southern Baptists between 1845 and 1975 than it is today? Urbanization and suburbanization, together with drastically increased mobility and proliferation of community-undermining technologies, have rendered the cultural soil on which churches must be planted much less hospitable to the building and nurturing of intimate and durable, or to use an emerging word, authentic Christian fellowship. Job and career changes that frequently uproot individuals and families, But perhaps just as significantly, the increased distances people drive to and from church, and also the distances between where we work, worship, play, and study, are all obstacles to the development of authentic relationships recognizable as anything like the body life depicted in Holy Scripture. The economic and sociological factors identified by David Wells 16 years ago in his book, No Place for Truth, are as relevant today as they were then. And remember, Wells argued that these patterns of living have a theological consequence because they undercut the body life, the church life, that is God's main tool by which He sanctifies us, by which He gets His way with us and deploys us for mission and ministry. Unless and until more Christian believers participate in communities of faith in which mutual encouragement, love, and accountability become dominant dimensions of their lives as followers of Jesus Christ, the conditions for robust living will continue to elude us. Is not some minimal amount of time spent with one another, some frequency of contact on a weekly basis, required for the formation and nurturing of something worthy of being called a Christian community? Emerging leaders think so. Where such minimum contact is not achieved, the means of theological shaping necessary to the people of God is undercut. God's especially chosen arena for blessing, sanctifying, disciplining, and deploying His children for the enjoyment and advance of the gospel, namely the church, is simply not being inhabited by believers in sufficient measure. Not necessarily in the building, but they're not inhabiting community with one another enough to achieve community. Where believers are deprived of the time and means required to develop commitment to one another, how can they be led to an appreciation of and commitment to their own local church, much less a denomination? They become abstractions. They become slices of their lives. Spirituality producing and feeding slices, but slices nonetheless. Well, what can be done? A lot is being done, not just by emerging churches, but many churches that recognize this problem. The obstacles to the formation and nurturing of genuine Christian community are enormous. They have worked their way into the warp and woof of our lives, and I fear our psyches. For example, I like some of the anonymity I've gained in the way my life is structured, but it's not good for me. We can fight back. Mark Dever encourages believers who are going to move to pick out a church first, then a house or an apartment. A fantastic way of putting God and community and church first. Where possible, try to worship in proximity to where you live and work. Some are establishing house churches or Bible study groups in homes which focus on the immediate neighborhood, not only as a strategy for penetrating those neighborhoods with the gospel, but also as an attempt to foster Christian community worthy of the name. Other churches, when they grow, are deciding to launch new church starts to discourage long-distance commutes. One urban congregation started a church in the suburbs to prevent the suburbanization of its vibrant urban ministry. These are strategic decisions driven by concern for community, shaped by theological conviction that the gospel is, by divine design, community-creating, community-based, and community-nourished, and that steps ought to be taken in these days to develop and protect conditions favorable to that community. Now, do not misunderstand. Neither the emerging church nor I am calling for a new asceticism. I love my laptop, and better not nobody touch my iPod. And if I can somehow manage to poison or otherwise kill my 10-year-old tube TV — my house was broken into a few days ago, and they didn't take the stupid tube TV — so that I could get a flat screen, high definition TV, which I need and desire. I love these gadgets, and I do not believe that they are intrinsically evil, but I also believe that the devil always makes good use of whatever is available, and that goes for both our mobility and these new technologies. Much excellent reflection has been given in answer to the question, what ought to characterize Southern Baptist churches in the 21st century? People are saying they ought to be more, they need to get back to the Bible. They need to be theologically orthodox and evangelical. We need to talk more about Baptist history. We need to stop running away from our denominational rootedness in the Baptist past. They need to be evangelistic. They need to be missional. Yes, 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 all of these things. But in what setting do we envision the accomplishment of such goals? I would suggest that settings where authentic community is achieved with high quality and depth will prove a fairly accurate predictor of how effective such efforts prove to be over time. Where that's not happening, how do we imagine conveying these things to our people? Otherwise, efforts will prove elusive. For Southern Baptist churches, the key to the accomplishment of most of what needs to happen seems strikingly clear in my mind. It is the ability of pastors, or at least this is something without which we will not achieve many of the things we want to. It's the ability of pastors to stay put in churches long enough to accomplish something. This is not happening in our churches, but where it does happen, where pastors stay and gain the trust of their congregations, they can pretty much have their way with them for good or ill, because they're trusted and they can lead. They can work for authentic community, for renewed denominational loyalty, or a thousand other things, and do so significantly, but only if they stay put. Now a word about commitment. The emerging church emphasis upon community runs up against a formidable obstacle, which I believe characterizes my own generation, the younger baby boomers, and subsequent generations of younger adults, including these emerging church folk especially. It is a pernicious refusal, almost an inability, to commit to much of anything. One explanation for the current hankering after community is that so many of us have so little or no experience of community or commitment whatsoever. So many have never been committed to by others, perhaps even by their parents. They lack models of commitment. The notion of a man and woman keeping marriage vows till death parts them some 5 to 7 decades after the ceremony strikes many of these young folk as a fantastic fantasy, not something that happens in the real world. And if it does, it's a great exception. It's like a lightning strike. Larger proportions of those who we are trying to reach grew up in broken homes, the biological father absent, and perhaps no father figure present at all. I have known my, even though I used to be a drug addict, I know all the lyrics to Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath songs. I thought I would be cool forever, and that is still true, because my generation invented cool, and so we'll always be cool. But I have known my whole life that there are at least a handful of people who would give their lives for me without thinking. I have always known that. But many we seek to reach today are confident and correct that not a tear would be shed if they dropped dead tomorrow. That's a different landscape that we're working in. This growing, broken, and love-deprived population has no plans and no memory of committing to anything. They have no plans to commit, no memory of committing to anyone or anything. It's not just the church pew that they don't sit all the way down in. They don't sit all the way down into any bridge-burning, covenant-shaped commitment of any kind. This is a great, great problem. Great ironies are here, an irony which the emerging church, with its quest for community, seems particularly conditioned to detect. The same folks yearning for genuine community, characterized by authentic relationships, exhibit palpable wariness or even inability for one of the indispensable building blocks of the true community they seek: commitment. What they want requires something that they are particularly weak at, because they haven't seen it done and they haven't done it themselves. They haven't committed to other people, much less institutions. The same powerlessness to make and keep commitments that results in serial marriage or the refusal to enter the bonds of marriage at all displays itself in church hopping and in the refusal to join a church. This same fierce protectiveness of the right to opt out of any relationship also helps to account for the fastest growing self-identification among believers in America, non-denominational. When I was in Thailand, I was in a church that was mainly full of college students, and so we split up, I and the one married Thai man with the men, and my wife with the one married Thai woman, to discuss with them the dating scene. And the Thai man, I said, you go first. He said, well, if you want to establish a long-term relationship in marriage, the most important thing you've got to do is you've got to be able to otton. It's a Thai word. It's really like the word hupomene in the New Testament. It means staying up under something. It means being able to put up with stuff. And if you don't have that, you're not going to make. You're going to have to put up with stuff if your marriage is going to work. And that's what we don't do. We don't put up with stuff. We drive away from stuff. But we do that in the face of a Bible in which we're taught that the fruit of the Spirit includes things like patience and long-suffering. And the Lord's Prayer encourages us that we should forgive us our trespasses as we forgive others. God knew there was going to be stuff to put up with. That's the place in which He shows off His ability, not only to reconcile Himself, a holy God, with us sinners, but show off how He can do that on the horizontal plane. But we don't get to do that because we don't know each other well enough to put up with much. And if we do encounter something, we drive away. And yet that's the place where God is going to make us a family. At a church in Indiana where I pastored, I noticed that members would leave after the pastor left. And so I want all you pastors to stay where you are. I left this church, though. I met with the families that joined while I was there. And I said, what do you want in a church? They said a lot of things. I want it to be a place where we belong, where we can count on people. It'll be like family. And I said, well, do you think the Pevlers and the Shills and the Sweeneys have that? These were long-standing members of the church, families of the church. Oh, yeah, they've got it. Well, how do you think they got it? All of these families I'd talked to them had thought about leaving at some point in the decades earlier. But they stayed. One thing they had to do to get it was stay. And I said, when I leave, this church will feel less like your church because I'll be gone. I was your pastor. And you can start all over if you want to, but you will be starting all over. You will be starting all over in gaining the things you want. A student at Beeson Divinity School, he's a doctrine-friendly emerging church pastor, former Southern Baptist, planning a church, pastoring a church in downtown Birmingham. He was intrigued, this Southern Baptist who says some friendly things about emerging. I said, why did you leave the denomination? Well, it was the things you would expect. It seems political. They don't listen to the young people. It's a lot of politics. It's a lot of fighting. I said, well, yeah. Kind of like families, actually, when you think about it. I said, how is it now that you've left the denomination? He said, well, you know, I'm glad I don't have to put up with the stuff I used to. But I also feel very disconnected. It's hard to be connected when you leave your family. A couple days later, all the mission sending agencies came to Beeson. And a young woman who was about the age she could have been my daughter sat beside me. She was from the IMB. Next thing you know, we got all kind of connections. We're talking about people we know. She'd been to Bangkok before. Had a wonderful conversation. And she left. I asked this young pastor, I said, do you see what happened? It was like meeting a family member I'd never met before. But it never could have happened without the denominational tie. It never could. We both left knowing that we were part of something together that was bigger than ourselves. But we'll never have that in marriage or in a local church or in a denomination until we learn how to put up with stuff and realize that God's anxious for us to put up with some stuff so He can show us His stuff. Well, there's many other things that go into the emerging church, a definition of the emerging church. I've highlighted a few. In closing, let me just say that I think some of the complaining and critiques of the emerging church against existing models of church are good ones. And they're actually offering some critiques that we are making too. It's not just their insights. And I think those among them who are theologically sound, they bring something to the table. And we bring something to them as well. All right. That's all I have. It's 19 after. I'd be happy to take... do I have someone who's going to cut me off at the right time? All right.
First of all, thank you. Thank you. We do have time for a few questions. If you'd like to ask of Dr. Devine, he'll have some divine answers, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
And then you went on to talk about a lot of missional terms. Do you think that maybe our near future as a denomination hinges more on our methodology of being able to connect more so than theological battles?
No, I don't. One of the striking things I remember reading in Nathan Finn's chapter in one of the books on theological or a Baptist identity was that today any church can affiliate with the Southern Baptist Convention basically just by sending some money. I'm not sure that's good. I think we need both theological tightening and loosening. Tightening in the sense that we need to become a more self-conscious and deliberate theological community of churches. I believe that's true. But with that, then I see that's what builds the trust that allows us to recognize methods that are, method and technique are not benign. All right? A lot of the church growth movement literature seems to suggest, they say, oh, the gospel stays the same, you know, but the methods change. And then when we survey evangelicals, we find out they're all over the map on what they think the gospel is. So it's only when we're grounded theologically, I think, that we have an internal theological antenna to detect when methods and techniques are not compatible with our message. But when we have that, then we have a basis of trust so that we can explore new ways, like missionaries, to reach our population. But no, theology matters more than method and technique. And we need theological grounding in order to be able to traverse this terrain of methodological experimentation and trial and error, I think.
Yes, sir.
Lyle.
Theologically, in a lot of ways, would match up, but would have differences there, and specifically with your experience in the Missouri area where that's kind of been a difficult topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we need to build a theological consensus that will inform us about how we relate to these groups. That will answer our questions. Acts 29 is not a denomination, but it does have a theological statement. Many of the Acts 29 churches are Southern Baptist churches. Okay? The replant in Kansas City was an Acts 29 replant, but it's a Southern Baptist church. And so, again, I think working on this theological issue, you know, and it's not easy, you know, it's that nasty theological conversation we have to have, but we have to have it. Because what we find is, of course, is that the depth of fellowship is proportional to shared conviction. That's true whether you're a liberal or a conservative, you see. These doctrine-averse emerging churches, they don't have formal doctrine. But when I converse with them, what I try to help them see is that they are theologically shaped. they like these dialogical sermons where you can interrupt and raise your hand. I said, well, what if on the first Sunday I come in and say, what you just said about narrative is really crazy. Your ideas on community, those are wrong. Narrative, the arts, mystery. And I do that every week. He said, oh, that would be disruptive. That wouldn't be welcome. Well, there's your doctrines. Those are your doctrines. You've got non-negotiable convictions. I'm so proud of you. Admit it. Get down here in the muck with the rest of us who believe things. And then we can have a conversation. But if somebody thinks they're occupying some doctrineless perch, it usually isn't so. And if it is so, it's not a church, of course. But the theology piece has to be solid, more solid than it is, to prevent us from either wrongly embracing or approving of some group like Acts 29 or dismissing it.
Probably have time for one more right there.
Mark, I know that many of us are interested in how we can learn from the emerging church movement in being able to connect with our communities better and being able to minister there. Can you give us some models in how we might be able to do that?
Well, I think part of the problem, of course, is that there's so much awful stuff in the emerging church movement. That's the battle I face all the time. I think on the doctrine-friendly side, a lot of these folks less and less want to be called emerging because they're always having the answer to the question, no, I don't agree with Brian McLaren on this or Doug Padgett or Tony Jones. And it just wastes a lot of time. They want to be called missional or something. That's fine. I think they're part of the same phenomenon because there's just too many things that they share. The problem is on the doctrine-friendly side, the things that matter most to their identity are not the things they share with the emerging church. What they share with the emerging church has more to do with cultural matters. But I think the key is theological grounding and allowing that to free us from undue anxiety about some of the things they do when they try to do church. Let that theological grounding allow for some patience and discussion of these young people. They're not achieving a lot of what... One of the things they want churches that have people of all ages in it, but they're not able to achieve it. The homogeneous unit principle seems to be worked into the warp and woof of a lot of church growth. So they end up with a bunch of people in their 20s and 30s. But they do care about that. They think that's bad. We'll see if these churches can age well and so forth. But I found out in Kansas City that some of these guys are really something. These two church planters that came there, they both had played football at Wheaton. They've got these football necks. If the rest of them shrivels up, they'll have that neck forever. And they moved into downtown Kansas City with their families. And they're reaching people in the neighborhood. So I would encourage you to be open to listening and ask theological questions and let that be a springboard to other matters that you might be able to discuss.
Thank you, Dr. Devine.
My pleasure. Thank you.